and restrictions around human reproduction, analysts say it is simply a matter of time before the organisation meets its demise. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Sudan condemns Ethiopia's start of second phase of filling the controversial Nile dam, warning the move violates existing agreements and threatens security in the region. The warning came after Sudan's Minister of Irrigation and Water Resources received a letter from Ethiopian counterpart informing him of the start of the second filling of the dam during the current rainy season. Despite drums of war appear, the government of Sudan ruled out any military solution to resettle the situation.
I think the military option, to my understanding, is out of question. It's not going to happen, especially for Sudan, because the battle will be in Sudan. And maybe Ethiopia will retaliate if they attack again, maybe they are going to retaliate in Osiris Dam or anywhere else. And the areas there will be affected. So, and this is not the solution.
Experts insist that no other option rather than negotiation within the international law is available for Sudan.
The National Court of Justice, which is an organ of the United Nations, according to its rules, no country can take another country to that court unless the country has already agreed to go before the International Court of Justice, and definitely Syria would not agree to that. So there is no international legal channel available to the government of Sudan.
Last month, Sudan and Egypt had sent a letter asking the UN Security Council to take up the issue. Talks mediated by the African Union, most recently in the Democratic Republic of Congo, have repeatedly stalled. According to Sudanese authorities, the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam is being built about 15 kilometers from border with Sudan on the Blue Nile, the source of most of the Nile's water, yet it affects life of 20 million people in this area.
As experts say, with the starting the next phase of filling the controversial mega dam on the Nile River by Ethiopia, the ball is now on the court of Sudan and Egypt. But as things stand, the two countries are still waiting for an action by the UN. Muhammad Ali Fazari, Khartoum.
The anti-Iran Mujahideen e Khalq organization, considered by many as a dangerous terrorist organization, will hold its annual meeting in Paris on Saturday. The notorious Cairn Academic Edition House, a kind of think tank for universities, published a study about the National Council of Resistance of Iran, NCRI, the umbrella organization of the MKO, with as conclusion, according to objective criteria, the NCRI is without any doubt a sectarian organization. The MKO is, among others, accused of separating children from their parents. So why do French authorities allow them to organize their annual conference?
If Mariam Rajavi is still in France and they still have their rallies every now and then in Paris, it means that the French want to be on both sides of the fence, like all the Europeans. France has an interest of having good relations with Iran. They had Total, which had invested a lot of money then, they'd probably want to go back.
In previous meetings of the MKO in Paris, the group had actively lobbied to obtain the support of mayors and members of parliament. The most visible support comes from French Member of Parliament Habib Meir, who has the double nationality, Israeli and French. He participates even in marches from the MKO here in 2016. Is there a link between Israel and the MKO terrorist organization?
Mujahideen have been linked closely to Israel. You have a report by two high officials from the CIA, which was publicized by NBC Radio in 2012, which said that the operations to assassinate the scientists and any other clandestine operations, terrorist operations inside Iran, were being planned or had been planned by the Israeli Secret Service and executed by members of the Mujahideen. So the Mujahideen have been working with the Israeli Secret Services ever since that time.
Also, important USA officials spoke at the conference. John Bolton, a former USA National Security Advisor, Rudolph Giuliani, former mayor of New York, and they receive money. USA speakers receive $25,000. French speakers receive $12,500. Media reports say that the money comes from the CIA, from Mossad, but mainly from Saudi Arabia. Experts say that European Union countries, and France in particular, want to eat from both sides. They tolerate the terrorist group on their territory and seek better relations with Iran, especially for economic reasons. It's not sure that this can work. Chris Den Hont, Paris.
Among the events that fall in this period is the 1981 bombing of the headquarters of Iran's Islamic Republic Party, carried out by the Mujahideen-e-Khalq terrorist organization known as the MKO. 73 leading officials, including the then-Justice Chief Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti, were killed in the incident. The U.S. and Europe do not recognize the MKO as a terrorist entity and hold regular meetings with the terror group, which is now based in France and Albania.
The MKO terrorists are puppets of the U.S. that have been trying to harm the Islamic Republic since its establishment. They carried out failed assassination of Ayatollah Khamenei when he was president in 1981. They have killed thousands of Iranians in different terrorist attacks, yet the U.S. and Europe delisted them as a terrorist entity and accommodate them. This shows how insincere are the Americans in their human rights slogans.
Activists here believe the U.S. has not changed its hostile behavior toward Iranians. They refer to the ongoing anti-Iran sanctions as economic terrorism that seeks to fulfill the same goals it failed to achieve in the 1980s.
The maximum pressure campaign sought to bring Iranians to their knees to finally pit them against the government. But as you see, this plot has failed, like several other conspiracies they hatched against Iran.
The victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution marked the end of decades of U.S. dominance over Iran's economy and its petroleum sector, something which is believed to be the main reason why the U.S. has made so many attempts to deal a blow to the Islamic Republic, including its support for Iraq in its 8 years of war against Iran and its unconditional support for the anti-Iran MKO terrorist group, and today by unleashing the toughest sanctions that have overshadowed Iran's health sector.
This gathering is held at the former U.S. Embassy in Iran, which is now turned into a museum that showcases documents of Washington's hostile agenda against Iran. Activists here say the U.S. adopts a selective approach towards the issue of human rights, at least in Iran. But they say it's time for the world to know the truth. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
An economic crisis came under the spotlight in Lebanon in October 2019 after the then government of Saad Hariri proposed plans to raise new taxes on tobacco, petrol, and voice calls via messaging services such as WhatsApp. The Hariri government sought to drum up more revenue amid a shortage of foreign currency, but the plans led to mass protests against economic turmoil and corruption. Eventually, the plans were called off and the government stepped down, but the financial situation continued to worsen amid the coronavirus pandemic. Hariri's successor, Hassan Diab, also resigned after a deadly explosion at the Beirut port in August 2020 that caused billions of dollars of damage. The Lebanese currency has so far lost more than 90% of its value, and more than half of the population has been sunk into poverty, as the country also faces severe fuel shortages. In the wake of the deepening economic crisis, Diab, who is a caretaker premier now, warned on Tuesday that Lebanon is only days away from what he called a social explosion. Diab, whose country has failed to form a new government in almost 11 months, also urged foreign donors to release financial aid to save the nation and do not link it to the government formation.
Linking aid to Lebanon with government formation has started to threaten the lives of people and to the Lebanese entity because the pressures that are being exercised and the siege imposed on Lebanon do not affect the corrupt. Instead, it is the Lebanese people who pay the heavy price that threatens their lives and their future.
On Monday, the Secretary General of the Hezbollah resistance movement blamed the United States for economic crises. Syed Hassan Nasrallah said Washington is wielding the threat of sanctions against the Lebanese government to prevent it from receiving aid from other countries. talks over the formation of a new cabinet have stalled as President Michel Aoun and Prime Minister-designate Saad Hariri remain at loggerheads over the coming government's makeup and reform agenda. This comes as the U.S. and some of its Western and regional allies are at odds with Beirut over the role of Hezbollah in Lebanon's politics. The resistance movement and its allies now hold the majority of parliamentary seats following elections in 2018. Irrespective of the ongoing crisis in Lebanon, the country's main woes are rooted in the power-sharing system, which is a legacy of the French colonialism. Nonetheless, many are worried that the political vacuum and chaos in Lebanon could plunge the Mediterranean nation into a new civil war like the one it experienced for 15 years until 1990.
Julian Assange recently turned 50 years old inside Belmarsh Maximum Security Prison in London. Despite winning his legal battle against extradition to the United States, he remains incarcerated in the UK's most notorious prison while awaiting the US government's appeal. The WikiLeaks co-founder faces 18 charges, 17 under the Espionage Act, for conspiracy to receive, obtain and disclose classified diplomatic and military documents. But many feel that his real crime was exposing US war crimes to the world. Assange's treatment, which UN Rapporteur Niels Melzer described as psychological torture, has caused outrage back in his native country of Australia, where over 600,000 people have signed a petition calling for his immediate release.
Despite the corporate media running dead on the issue, basically, and not supporting him, there has been a groundswell and there's been a lot of campaigns. There are regular rallies, and of course, but we rely on the social media and other forms of media because the corporate media has been so locked out because they have been in lockstep with all of these 8 wars in the Middle East in the last 20 years.
This also prompted Australian MPs from across the political spectrum to issue a statement via video message to US President Joe Biden to drop the espionage charges against the Australian citizen and for the British government to allow him to return home.
Citizens expect us to protect journalists and publishers, not to imprison them for their work.
So far, Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison has refused to back campaigners' call for his release and said Assange should not receive, quote, special treatment. Press TV spoke to Australian academic Tim Anderson and asked him what he thought of these comments by the Conservative Prime Minister.
Well, unfortunately, we have a long tradition in Australia of governments kowtowing to Washington, and particularly the Conservative ones. The Conservative ones have been huge enthusiasts for doing whatever Washington wants them to do. So unfortunately, that's a tradition we live with, and it takes an extraordinary amount of pressure to shift them to lift their fingers and do something that Washington might not agree with. But nevertheless, the pressure is being raised here.
The pressure on Joe Biden's administration to drop the charges against Julian Assange is mounting, with not only Australian MPs demanding his release, but also Italian parliamentarians calling for the recognition of his political refugee status. But will any of this sway the US, who seem as determined as ever to extradite the co-founder of WikiLeaks? Ahmed Kabela, London.
Violence has escalated in Afghanistan since the official declaration in May by US President Joe Biden to withdraw remaining American troops from Afghanistan by September 11. Since then, the Taliban have intensified their attacks on hundreds of district centers across the country, many of these dramatically falling into the hands of the militant group one after another across the nation.
The situation is getting worse day by day. The Taliban have captured several districts and are expanding their hold on most of highways now under their control. Northern provinces are also the scene of a rise in Taliban attacks, but government forces are not confronting them seriously.
Despite Taliban's advance, government officials have described the fall of those districts into the hands of militants as an outcome of a tactical retreat by Afghan troops who have no much support of foreign forces on the ground now. However, the Taliban militant group seemingly doesn't care about what officials in Kabul talks about the reasons of the fall of dozens of districts. Instead, the group is still trying to bring more lands under its sway. But things seem to be not in favor of the Taliban as they expect because of prevailing public anger, as because many Afghans are against the revival of the Taliban rule over the country due to the group's dogmatic ideology, especially when it comes to social liberties. As a matter of fact, locals have formed armed fronts to resist Taliban attacks.
We support public resistance fronts against the Taliban. There is no doubt these forces have created serious obstacles on the way of Taliban and stopping them from gaining more ground. They will defeat the Taliban in close cooperation with our army and police forces if the government honestly supports them.
The move has been fruitful as public uprising forces have retaken several key districts from the Taliban, mainly in northern Tahar and southern Ghazni provinces. The back-to-back fall of districts to the Taliban has also created doubts among locals who say the retreat of Afghan forces from some key districts is unusual. The doubts have raised concerns of a strong revival of Taliban and their possible secret deals. Syed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
During a conference held by media outlets and attended by media, political and academic figures, Lebanon's Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah lauded the work of the press, especially in its coverage of the last round of fighting in Al-Quds battle. Said Nasrallah began by stressing that the media is a partner in all victories and needs to focus on where the confrontation lies and with whom.
We cannot liberate Palestine without breaking the U.S. hegemony in our region. This hegemony provides the Zionist regime with all required means for its survival. Only 12 days into the Al-Quds battle, the Zionist regime called for aid from the U.S. Therefore, in our discourse, we cannot exclude the U.S. role in the region.
Sayyid Nasrallah highlighted the points of strength of the resistance media, which he says the rival media lacks: honesty, integrity, and the mere fact of backing a righteous cause and facing injustice makes the media of the resistance more reliable, according to the leader of the resistance. The broadcast networks at the conference agreed that there is much work to be done. Some experts at the conference believed the media should develop to the extent that it becomes makers of news and writers of the discourse.
Reviewing the literature accumulated since the world wars and the modern-day conflicts, we always see a discourse in the making. Resistance media have raised the standards of news writing. Today, our media are not just the transmitters of the news.
Experts at law also spoke at the conference, suggesting that there needs to be a focus on the war crimes of the Israeli entity, while focusing on legal terminology.
The crimes that Israel commits against Palestinians, the crimes are really crimes against humanity and all kinds of crime. Israel should really be punished for what is she pursuing and what is she committing against Palestinians and Israel. The occupation is illegal by law, by international law, and this is why on the other side it's very legal for the Palestinian to fight for their freedom, to free Palestine, to free Palestine and to free the people of Palestine.
The meetings concluded with an emphasis on highlighting the regional equation of protecting Jerusalem al-Quds from any Israeli aggression.
The conference today brings together tens of media outlets which consider themselves in alliance with the resistance forces in the region and speak on their behalf. Sayyid Nasrallah has given his blessings to the men and women in this field while also calling on them to reinvent and strengthen their media discourse. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, Thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. Syria says the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons has turned from a technical organization into a political tool by the U.S., U.K., and France to exert pressure on Damascus. Addressing an OPCW meeting, Syria's mission to the UN body said the actions of the Global Chemical Weapons Watchdog contradicts the principles of impartiality, since the United States has the largest chemical arsenal in the world, and the munitions pose a grave threat to international peace and security. The U.S., France, and Britain have long accused Syria of using chemical weapons against its people. This is while Syria surrendered its stockpile of chemical weapons back in 2014 to a joint mission led by the U.S. and the OPCW, which oversaw the destruction of the weaponry. For more on that, we're joined by our correspondent, Mohammed Abi, who's with us from the Syrian capital, Damascus. Mohammed, welcome to the program. Please tell us more about these recent comments coming from Damascus.
Yes, actually, the comments were from came out from the head of Syria's mission at the OPCW in a meeting there. Raniel Rifai said that the OPCW has turned from a technical organization into a political tool in the hands of the United States, France, Britain, and other Western countries that have been implementing policies in line with the U.S. ones in order to pressure Syria and falsely accuse it various accusations such as still having chemical weapons over here. Now, also, Rifai, Rana Rifai, said that Syria fulfilled all of its commitments when it joined the OPCW back in 2013. And, of course, we all remember how the international community acknowledged that Syria destroyed all of its chemical weapons. However, we still continue to hear accusations by the West that Syria still has chemical substances. Now, we also have to point out that head of Syria's mission, Rania Rifai, also criticized those claims by the United States and its allies that claim that Syria has chemical weapons, saying that those are lies and fabrications. Also, a very important point is Syria always argues and asks a question. Whenever those countries accuse Syria, Syria was in a state of advancing. The Syrian army was advancing against terrorists. So there's a question. Why would a country like Syria use chemical weapons when, one, it has no chemical weapons, two, the ordinary weapons were doing the job against the terrorists?
All right, thanks a lot. Muhammad Ali joining us from Damascus. Let's take a look at our guests for tonight's Spotlight. We have veteran war zone correspondent and political analyst with over 35 years of experience covering West Asia, North Africa, Mr. Elijah Magnea, joining us from Brussels. And also expert on West Asian affairs and former British ambassador to Syria, Peter Ford, joins us from Manchester. Let's start off with Mr. Ford in Manchester. Sir, Syria says that the Global Chemical Weapons Watchdog is no longer a technical organization, but a political tool in the hands of the United States, the UK, and France to exert pressure on Damascus. How do you view these comments?
Yes, sadly, I have to agree 100% with that take on the OPCW. It's a tragedy that this very important international monitoring body should be corrupted in this way by being politicized by Western powers. The OPCW should be playing an impartial role and should be seen to be extremely impartial, but for the last few years, in decision after decision, it has shown that it is a puppet of the Western powers. Now, Britain and America in particular are responsible here. They have stuffed this organization with seconded officials from their own administrations who do not respect the impartiality of the OPCW but carry out the wishes of their masters in Washington and London. And this is basically why the OPCW is well on the way being completely discredited.
Well, the organization's first president, Brazilian diplomat José Bustani, he backed and expressed his grave concerns over the tampering of the 2018 Duma report, fearing that the OPCW had become a tool of the U.S. government. Give us your take on those comments from the former head of the organization. Those are pretty much identical to what Damascus is saying right now.
Well, he's absolutely right, Mr. Bustani, and he's well-placed to know, given his previous position. But I'm afraid in the UN system, and I used to work in the UN after I left the British diplomatic service, I'm afraid in today's UN, if you don't follow the US narrative on important issues, you will never get to be Director General of an organization like OPCW. This organization and other agencies of the UN have become highly politicized by the Western powers just in the last 15 years. And he's absolutely correct that the initial report done by the technical inspectors who went to Duma produced a clear conclusion that there was no evidence of a chemical weapons attack. And this report was, once it got to headquarters in The Hague, was doctored by the Western officials working within the office of the Director General to produce the opposite conclusion. Why? Well, in order to justify the bombing of Syria, which has taken place even without waiting for the investigation by the OPCW inspectors.
Let's cross over now to Elijah Magny in Brussels. Mr. Magny, revelations, they suggest that the OPCW may have intentionally doctored its findings about the alleged gas attacks in Syria. The scandal, as we know, continued to grow throughout 2020 as OPCW experts. They came forward, they gave testimony as to how their findings had been completely manipulated or ignored in order to present a one-sided or quote-unquote incorrect view of events in order to further an agenda. Is that what Damascus meant when it repeatedly urged the chemical weapons watchdog to avoid politicizing Syrian issues?
Indeed. As your guest said, rightly said, the OPCW is politicized. And when Jose Bustani came out with his narrative saying that we are, the inspectors are technical and scientists, and according to the scientist opinion, there is no chemical attack on Douma. And the reason why the OPCW is insisting is to justify the US, UK, and France attack on Damascus. And the whole world watched how the OPCW is lacking trust these days, particularly after the Douma attack. And it is obvious that a lot of pressure was put on the organization that needs honest watchdog and need honest observer and scientist to go on the site and tell us what's happening, but without taking a side and without being doctrinized by the superpower or the US or the UK opinion. Otherwise, there is no need for them to go and inspect on the ground if the decision is made before the attack.
I'm going to stay with you, Mr. Magny. Why would the OPCW, even under pressure, suppress information and its findings? Just thinking about the consequences, what would this do to the body's credibility?
The aim was to attack President Assad that was winning a large part of Syria and freeing most of his territory. And when the international community that worked very hard to overthrow President Assad and allow Al-Qaeda and ISIS to gain territory, notwithstanding the huge investment that the Western countries and many Gulf countries, including Turkey, invested in Syria, it was just an excuse to look for, to bomb President Assad. Even though everybody knows that at the time of the bombing in 2018, it was too late to change the balance on the ground. So bombing for bombing, it didn't make any sense. And regardless, the US, UK, and France went ahead and bombed three positions, and they told us that they were chemical sites. I mean, how can you bomb chemical sites and not risk the spread of chemical product and material in the air that can affect everybody, including civilians in Syria? It didn't make absolutely no sense.
Peter Ford, Damascus, along with Russia, have said in the past that chemical attacks had been staged in Syria in order to incriminate Damascus. There are a lot of arguments that Douma was a false flag attack. Who benefits from these actions? The cover-ups, the alleged false flag attacks, who gains from all of this?
The Western powers and the so-called rebels, obviously. The Western powers needed to justify their illegal bombing of Syria. That's why they can never admit that it was carried out on the basis of a falsehood. That's why they must continue to sustain this lie. But there's another deeper, more topical reason. They have to justify the continuing war on Syria, which mainly takes the form of economic warfare in the shape of sanctions and withholding reconstruction assistance. In order to continue this these cruel sanctions which penalize and punish the ordinary Syrian people, the Western powers have to maintain the narrative that Assad is the president who gasses his people. So this fakery is the cornerstone of the propaganda strategy which underpins the economic warfare on Syria, and that continues, and that's why they continue to hound Syria over this non-issue of chemical weapons.
Elijah Magnier, same question to you. If you recall, Russia recently warned of possible upcoming false flag attacks to maybe justify exerting more pressure on Damascus. Who actually benefits from all of this?
Well, as Peter rightly said, the only beneficial is just to keep sustaining the narrative of what the U.S. is offering us, including the EU, to impose sanctions on Syria. And now the U.S. and the EU don't have any politics or any strategy to carry on in Syria. All their options are bad from their point of view. So what they are doing is to starve the population and thinking that maybe with sanctions they can curb the public opinion and turn it against President Assad, or perhaps they force Assad to come and negotiate with them. And this is not going to happen. The people are getting used to very harsh sanctions, and they are suffering. The local currency is devalued. All the goods are extremely unaffordable for everybody in Syria. And what the only benefit is, just because the Americans don't have any clear policy, they don't know what to do, to stay or to leave. So what they do is they maintain the sanction under very different excuses, including the chemical attack.
Peter Ford, there were a lot of, the scandal coming out of the Duma attack, there was a lot of calls for reinvestigating the evidence instead of reopening the investigation into places like Duma. The OPCW took a step further and suspended Syria's rights at the weapons watchdog, citing a lack of cooperation. The question is, why should Syria cooperate with the OPCW at all?
It's a very good and fair question. The OPCW, since Duma, or the Americans and the British and the French have tried to give new powers and create new investigating committees and groups and sub-bodies over which they themselves will have more control, all in order to keep up the pressure on Syria and to some extent Russia, and to keep trying to exploit this issue. But the fact remains that the inspectors have only been able to carry out one proper investigation into an alleged site of an alleged use of chemical weapons, and that was Duma. And in that case, the first group of scientists and technical experts found that there was no evidence of a chemical attack. And this is why the Western powers have to keep trying to create new groups which will be more amenable to manipulation. It's no wonder that Syria simply refuses to have anything to do with them. They're illegal anyway. They've been set up, these new investigative bodies, they've been set up illegally in terms of UN law.
Elijah Magnier, when the OPCW scandals were unfolding, one journalist took to social media writing that this should be a global scandal. Quote, the suppression of evidence from experts from the OPCW in order to push for war in Syria. This cover-up was ignored by mainstream media. Why was it ignored?
Because there is no accountability for whatever superpower and countries like the US, UK, and France are doing in Syria. Their presence is illegal, and the mainstream media is supporting them because they've been bombarded by the necessity to remove President Assad from power. Everybody has adopted this narrative, and the consequences were unimportant. At the end of the day, after 11 years or 10 years of war, the President Assad is still in power and the Syrian government is stable. Now they're not willing to back off and change the narrative. This is why they don't care about scandal. If the OPCW has lost credibility or not, all world leaders have lost credibility in Syria, not only in Syria, even in other parts of the Middle East. Therefore, this is no longer something that those searching for the truth or voicing the truth can do much about it, at the exception of just mentioning it and just saying it. And the other side is just even closing their eyes or keeping pursuing the same narrative.
Peter Ford, one last question for you. Here's a concerning thought. If the likes of the U.S., the U.K., France, etc., they can pressure the OPCW for their own agendas, then they could very well be doing the same with other international bodies too. Give us your final thoughts.
Absolutely. And thankfully, much of the world is waking up to this danger. Interestingly, 29 countries all around the world voted against the April suspension of Syria's voting rights in OPCW. That's 29 countries who are very alive, I'm sure, to the danger that you just mentioned, that this could be just the beginning of how the international system is manipulated against them and not just Syria.
All right, thanks a lot. Allow me to thank my guest, Mr. Elijah Magnier, joining us from Brussels. Also, thanks to former British ambassador to Syria, Peter Ford, joining us from Manchester. And a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight. It's good night for now, and see you next time.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
At the peak of first and second waves last year, when Iran was one of the hardest hit countries in the region, it was a leader of the Islamic Revolution who stood like a rock behind the country's frontline health workers. He even declared those who fell in the line of duty as martyrs. We now present you an article written by Sayed Zafar Mahdi, a Tehran-based journalist, editor, and blogger with over 10 years of experience, who has reported extensively from Kashmir, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Iran for leading publications worldwide. The piece is titled, Iran's Leader Walks the Talk on Battle Against COVID-19. Please stay with us for more of Sayed Zafar Mahdi's article. The cataclysmic COVID-19 pandemic has wreaked havoc across the globe, bringing daily lives to a grinding halt in much of the world. In the words of United Nations Chief Antonio Guterres, it is the greatest challenge the world has faced since the Second World War. Some countries, though, have been hit harder than others, not because of incoherent or disorganized response, but due to external pressures from those seeking to weaponize the pandemic. In Iran, it has been a grueling fight under extremely challenging conditions. The country, battling cruel sanctions, with assets worth billions of dollars frozen abroad, has already overcome four deadly waves of the pandemic. And the battle continues, both against the pandemic and those weaponizing it. What is phenomenal, though, is how the Islamic Republic, notwithstanding heavy and seemingly insurmountable odds, has quite literally defeated the US maximum pressure campaign with maximum resistance and maximum resilience in a time of pandemic. This has been made possible by the visionary leadership of Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the torchbearer of the Islamic Revolution. The decision against importing US and UK-made vaccines and insistence on producing an indigenous vaccine was one of his masterstrokes, which not only illustrated his unflinching faith in local scientific talent, but marked a key step towards neutralizing the impact of sanctions and making the countries increasingly self-reliant. At the peak of the first and second waves last year, when Iran was one of the hardest hit countries in the region, it was a leader of the Islamic Revolution who stood like a rock behind the country's frontline health workers. He even declared those who fell in the line of duty as martyrs. When complaints were made about lack of adherence to health protocols in big cities, he appeared on television wearing a face mask and urged others to do the same. During the month of Muharram, he was seen sitting quietly in one corner of his otherwise jam-packed mosque, wearing a face mask and listening to the elegy reciters. These were incredibly inspiring efforts to promote the COVID-19 guidelines and undoubtedly saved scores of lives. When vaccines were rolled out in the West, and almost all regional countries made beelines to have them, Iran's leader said no to the United States and UK-made vaccines. Some thought of it as irrational, while others knew that the move was properly calculated. This was not merely a rejection of foreign vaccines, it was a path-breaking move towards building self-sufficiency through domestic production, while encouraging local scientific talent and becoming a major vaccine hub in the region. Also, the untold and unheard of loud and clear, the killers cannot be your saviors. At that time, very few would have thought that Iran will come up with a homegrown vaccine in such a short span of time, under the ominous specter of economic terrorism and maximum pressure campaign. It came up not with one, but four vaccines, with two of them already getting the nod for mass production. Again, the leader of the Islamic Revolution walked the talk. He took the first vaccine shot of locally produced vaccine, Coviran Barakat, produced by Shafar Pharmaceuticals, under camera in the presence of top health officials. This was enormously significant. The country's top official, in a show of extraordinary faith and trust in his young scientists and their untapped potential, turns up his sleeve, looks straight into the camera, and calls it a source of honor and pride. As one Twitter user wrote, on the face of it, it appeared that the leader was getting the vaccine, but in reality, the vaccine was against the pandemic of despair and self-doubt amongst the people. It restored people's faith in the sanctions-battered healthcare system and the country's young scientists. In his remarks after getting the vaccine shot, the leader said he was not willing to receive a foreign-made vaccine, so he waited for an Iranian-made vaccine. He also lavished praise on those involved in producing the country's first licensed vaccine. Appreciating the efforts of all knowledge-based firms presently involved in the production of vaccines in Iran, the leader said, "It is very important to honor this national achievement in the true sense of the word. Why should we not use it when we have the opportunity to prevent or cure a disease inside the country?" He also urged local vaccine developers to publish documents and other relevant scientific papers relating to the vaccine for the world to benefit from, unlike those billionaires in the West who refuse to share COVID-19 vaccine formulas with developing countries, and those elites who hoarded the surplus vaccines. Looking back at the timeline of the COVID-19 pandemic in Iran, it becomes crystal clear that the leader of the Islamic Revolution was from day one sure about the capabilities of local scientists to produce a vaccine with high efficacy. From May 2020, when he called for the production of a homegrown vaccine, to June of 2021, when he proudly said that the Islamic Republic of Iran was among five or six countries to produce an indigenous vaccine, and that too under cruel economic sanctions. What is important to note here is that the battle isn't only against the pandemic, but also against the hopelessness and despair that it created, especially in places where vaccines haven't reached yet. The leader's words resonate widely and carry a message for all those people across the world fighting the pandemic and all those people fighting those weaponizing the pandemic. We can beat both if leaders lead from the front.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.